Welcome to Atmospheric Tales, a podcast that amplifies stories and experiences related to air pollution and climate change from around the world.
I'm Yuro Shahzad Ghani, and welcome to another episode of Atmospheric Tales. Our guest today is Azjagal Sotsar Khan, who leads business development at ORDA Wealth Tech from Silicon Valley, California. She's passionate about solving public health, sustainability, and social problems, as had founded Breathe Mongolia Clean Air Coalition, a nonprofit with the mission to eradicate air pollution in Mongolia. She holds a BA in Finance and Marketing from the University of Technology, Sydney, and an MBA from Birmingham Young University, with extensive experience in finance, nonprofit, and technology sectors, including 9 years at IBM. She's also a board member of other human rights and climate change nonprofits and a co-author of Clean Air Adventures children's book. Our interviewer today is Geratuya Bayan Munk, who is a startup founder pursuing an MSc in Artificial Intelligence and Data Science at St. Petersburg University, having previously earned her BSc in Mathematics from the National University of Mongolia. She specializes in using AI and big data techniques in fields requiring interdisciplinary innovation and action, such as climate tech and public health. With previous experience as a web developer and an engineer, Geratuya founded her startup, Green Dot Climate, to create science-backed climate change content, develop climate tech solutions, build youth-led communities and campaigns, and form partnerships to push Mongolia towards a net-zero future. Welcome to the show, Aza and Geratuya.
Thank you, Shahzad, for your kind introductions. Welcome to the episode of the Atmospheric Tales podcast, Aza.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm grateful to meet the Atmospheric Tales team. I've been following your podcast for a while now. It's an honor to be here.
Thank you. Aza, you and I both grew up in Mongolia. While our home country is known for having the coldest capital city in the world, Ulaanbaatar, it is also home to a much harsher reality, as you and I know. Despite its relatively small population of 2.3 million people, which is almost 70% of the whole population of Mongolia, Ulaanbaatar consistently ranks among the world's most polluted cities. A number of factors come into play here, which directly and indirectly affect the air quality in this region. Would you first like to elaborate on the same?
Yeah, sure. So I just want to add a disclaimer. When it comes to air pollution in Mongolia, we should not think about only Ulaanbaatar city, the capital city. The rest of the country also has the same problem, maybe on a smaller scale with a smaller population. But when we talk about air pollution in Mongolia, we should talk about the entire country. And I am from Erdenet. It's a smaller city. It's a mining town. And my hometown also has a major air pollution problem. So to get back to the factors that affect air quality, in our capital city and also all the urban centers in the country, it's a symptom of a developmental challenge. There was a UN voluntary report in 2019, a voluntary report on the SDGs that came out, and it did say that air pollution, the systemic issues and all the interrelated factors that go into it, it's just the face of all the challenges that we face as a country. So what contributes to air pollution is very complex, starting from lack of energy infrastructure. It's not equitably accessible to all the residents in the country. It's a rural-urban migration problem, urban planning problem. On top of it, we have the climate change, extreme weather events, and poverty and economic issues. And then when it comes to direct causes of air pollution, I think it's similar to many other countries. In our case, it's coal-fired power plants, coal-burning stoves, old vehicles that make up around 80% of all the vehicles in our country, construction dust, waste incineration, even ashes from the coal that we burn in our homes. For example, a household in a Gir district or households live in the outskirts of the city, they burn around 4 tons of coal every winter, and 1 ton of it is already coal ash that does not get disposed of properly. And most of the time, it just goes into the general waste, or it just is thrown out in the street. and then causes additional pollution. And then with that, we have to face all the health impact from it. And even between 2009 and 2019, lung cancer rate increased 56%. Our cardiovascular issues like stroke and heart attacks, heart disease rates increased like 20-30% within a decade. So it's definitely a major public health crisis, I would say. And to go back to the point that I made about air pollution being a nationwide problem, we have a city called Baiyang-Honghor City. It's a province of, it's located in one of the provinces of Mongolia. And we analyzed that data from the air quality monitors over there. And we found out that around almost 3 months out of the year, people would breathe good quality air, but the rest of the time, it's not healthy. And there are 32,000 residents living in that area. And just another surprising fact is that on a day where the air quality was the highest, the pollution level was, PM2.5 level was 237 micrograms per cubic meter. And it's almost as bad as smoking 11 cigarettes a day. And I want to add that you and I, everyone in Mongolia is affected by it, whether they live in Mongolia or outside of Mongolia. One of our family, at least one of our family members, have suffered, or even ourselves have suffered, the health consequences of it.
Yeah, thank you, Aza, for pointing out that air pollution is a nationwide issue in Mongolia. I really resonated with this because my grandparents live in Langgom and they experience air pollution and they experience the impacts of air pollution every day, although they may not name it that. Okay, so on the impacts of air pollution, I'd like to talk to you about the slow violence of environmental crisis. This term was coined by Rob Nixon in 2011. The term slow violence has been used to describe the mundane and sometimes even invisible ways in which the most marginalized communities are being threatened by environmental degradation and human-induced climate change. And this occurs as people are denied basic needs through social, economic, and political structures. How have you seen this unravel in different cities in Nagoya through your research with Brief Nagoya, in addition to what you already said in answer to the previous question? And how and why are pre-existing public structures failing to address this issue?
I might not be able to answer everything. However, as you can see, it's because it's a country's developmental challenge, and we're a developing country with a high rate of poverty, where there's quite a bit of inequality, and even the budget allocation is not fair to everyone. For example, in about a decade ago, when we had an economic boom and many people were coming back to the country, and there was quite a bit of foreign investment, and we had a you know, large budget to allocate to all the important sectors, but not enough. There was no change in the budget allocated to education and health. And now we're suffering the consequences of it, with children under five, you know, are dying at a high rate due to pneumonia. And we were impacted by COVID dramatically, and even including my father too. Also, because air pollution is an urban planning problem, an energy access, accessibility, and affordability problem, Gare District, our province centers are mostly affected by it, and people have to resort to burning whatever they find or the coal that they can afford. And those districts and neighborhoods don't get enough budget to improve their infrastructure, to get access to electricity or even reliable electricity, and they have to pay more for the electricity than the people in the apartments. So they're not aware of the possibility that there is enough budget and it's just not being allocated to them. There's a research done about that too. So public awareness and education is crucial. So they know their rights. So they have the right to science, and they demand to get their health and human rights protected. When it comes to exposure as well, low-income districts experience the highest and most direct impact of air pollution. And just like many other countries, women and children are disproportionately exposed to indoor air pollution. And then it also is differentiated by occupation. And when it comes to those who bear the cost of being impacted by air pollution, it's mainly also women and girls or women and children. And there was a study made by UNICEF called Cost of Absenteeism Due to Air Pollution Among Private Sector Companies in Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia. They found out that mostly female employees with young children had to be absent due to air pollution-related health issues. And they had to lose about, when they calculated all the direct and indirect costs to it, basically 10% of their income was spent on healthcare issues related to air pollution. And it cost, not only cost the families, but it cost the private sectors and the companies too. And they concluded the loss being representing 1.4 million annual hidden indirect opportunity costs to the Mongolian economy due to air pollution. And then when you get sick and go to the hospital, there's not enough beds. And some of them even have to lie on the floor, on the mattress to get medical treatment. So that's unfair. When it comes to accessibility to affording health protective items like masks or air purifiers, that's also an injustice. It can cost about even somebody's, half or third of their monthly income, and not everybody can afford that. When we worked with community members in a lower income district, it would cost them almost three times their monthly salary to afford an insulation product to improve the energy efficiency in their home and afford an electric heater. And we raised some funds to subsidize for those costs as well. So just to go back to your question, the entire system and how we run the country and how we plan our city and how we cater to those, to the most vulnerable and the less advantaged, will make the biggest difference in combating this issue. And all the different stakeholders and sectors have to come together, and they need to understand their own role in it. It's not just one sector's, one demographic's problem.
Great answer. Okay, now let's talk more on the solutions. Given your experience and background working in technology at IBM and Orsda and beyond, how do you see the usage of elements from that sector towards furthering awareness and action on air pollution in Mongolia? How can new and upcoming technologies, including AI, aid in fast-tracking air quality measurement and management processes that may often take longer due to old technologies? What's your take on that?
Having worked at IBM for 9 years and working with tech colleagues from all over the world, even at Breed Mongolia, have taught me quite a bit about the importance of technology in this work. When I was just getting started, I paired up with our current CTO, Oyang Kambathar. She's a software engineer at Adobe right now. And we created a remote team to build air quality monitoring platform with data from low-cost sensors. I paid out of pocket, and then we collaborated with some other nonprofits and had access to their sensor data. And so far, we worked on 30-plus projects with 100-plus volunteers to create social media content using all the latest technological tools like Creative Cloud or Canva, or, we have access to master classes that we got grant from, and we can build capacity for our volunteers and workers. And then I got to work with UX designers and researchers and software engineers from IBM, Google, eBay, and HP. And everyone worked on a volunteer basis. And we built another platform, Agarnik. It's an air pollution knowledge management and a collaboration platform where all the stakeholders in Mongolia can come together and upload their project and their latest news and find follow up on each other's progress. So there is no redundancy in the financial and human resources. There was an incident where World Bank was working, started a project that UNICEF already worked on, and they didn't know. If they knew about it, they could have, you know, learned from their mistakes and come up with another project. So that information exchange and that transparency is important, and that's possible through technology. Right now, we're working on making the data from the government sensors accessible, because it's still not accessible and open to the public, and it costs money to access it. So we're working on procuring additional devices to supplement the data gathering process and also advocate for accessible reference-grade data. When it comes to even the latest technology, I just took a course on AI. You're the expert on AI, Gajriya, but I'm just getting there. We're working on setting up our workflow, educational content workflow, and automating it using AI and other automation tools. So, you know, it's more efficient and more streamlined because we don't have enough people and financial resources to work like a news agency, you know? And then we operate like a tech startup using the latest tools like Mural, Slack, Notion, Airtable. So not only we're always keeping up to date with the latest tools, we're also building capacity within our people. So it's pretty exciting, and I'm always learning.
Great. Working with Aza and her team at Bremen Goya, I for sure know that they use technology to a great extent. And I also recall our meeting in Zambatar in, I think, 2017, where you were investigating the air pollution issue in Nagoya and establishing the Breathe Nagoya team. Since then, our communication has mostly been online, right? I'm interested in hearing your insights on the specific challenges and opportunities associated with building and managing an international team while addressing such a locally felt and locally solved issue like air pollution. Could you please share your perspective on the nuances of advocacy from abroad in this context?
Yes, yeah, sure. It's definitely been interesting. I started my advocacy in New York City, Times Square. When I learned about air pollution, I could not sit still. And I could not just fly off to UB to join the protests. So I decided to organize my own little protest in at Times Square. And then a viral photo got the attention of people all around the world. And many people reached out to join and asking for, what can I do? I'm, you know, I'm a project manager, or I'm an engineer, or I'm a marketer. What can I do? I want to do something. I'm frustrated. So right now we've worked with over 100 people from 15 plus countries from all kinds of backgrounds. So it's been really encouraging, motivating, and exciting that anyone can do something from anywhere in the world. And we've built so much together as a team. For example, there was a girl, high schooler, Marvat. She lives in Bagnor. It's quite a distance from capital city. And she's not able to, you know, join all the youth events and the trainings and be active. But she is suffering the consequences of air pollution. Even her family members have health issues, and she wanted to make a difference. And she could work with us. And then we trained her to contribute to the Smithsonian Institute's Youth Environmental Justice Handbook. And then, like I said before, you know, Google's engineer in Singapore or IBM's engineer in UK, they could work together to build the air quality knowledge management platform. And we have an advisor from NASA right now, atmospheric scientist. So it's been definitely really, really fun. But however, after operating remotely for a few years, we realized that it's not enough. We need more presence on the ground. We need to be on the top of the local news and local events and meet people in person. As much as I traveled to Mongolia, I couldn't join most of the meetings in person. And it was limiting to join them remotely and virtually and send letters and emails and petitions. So we raised enough funds. Specifically, our co-founder, Inghung Byamdor, she raised quite a bit of funds recently from AstraZeneca and Lead 2030 challenge to cover most of our operational expenses for the next few years. So now we have team on the ground who who can go and meet people in person, lobby with government officials and collaborate with other nonprofits and directly with community members. So right now, I think we have the perfect combination where local team implements the project, adjusts according to the local needs, and the international team of volunteers and scientists and advisors can provide support and fill in the gaps.
Great. We are all so thankful for what you do at Bimagoya, for sure. And I also personally underscore the challenges associated with advocating for environmental justice in relatively new democracies such as our home country, Mongolia. The journey is not always a seamless one. So it's really crucial to recognize and celebrate both significant milestones and smaller victories. With that in mind, could you share some of the most noteworthy and special wins Brit Mongolia has experienced over the years, including the AstraZeneca challenge winning, etc.? Additionally, what are your aspirations for this year and beyond?
As I said before, one of the things that I'm pretty proud of is that there was no one centralized place where people could understand what the heck is going on in Mongolia. So our platform, breedmongolia.org, it's a bilingual platform with live, real-time, low-cost, or sometimes reference-grade data as well, that shows daily air quality information, not only of Ulaanbaatar, but of the entire country. We have purple air sensors of the entire country and province centers as well. So they can go to our website and see, okay, what's the air quality in our province, not just capital city. So we filled that gap in there. And then we created very comprehensive resources on our website called Take Action. And we detailed out exactly what to do, how to do it in Mongolian context to protect their health and reduce individual emissions as well. So people are not, so they don't feel powerless and helpless in this situation. There's so much to do. And then now we're working on more policy advocacy work. We want people to understand what needs to change in a systemic level and how they can contribute to it, how they can support it, who they can contact, who they can demand decisions from. For example, right now we're awaiting the finalization of indoor air quality standard. As a country, we don't have that. We're waiting for a director of one organization, the ministry, to approve it so that we can measure the indoor air quality and assess that it's violating the standard, and we must take action as a country and institution. So we have around 34,000 users who visit the platform so far. And the other accomplishment was the Aramnik collaboration platform. It's also bilingual, so there is no language gap. You know, foreign non-Mongolian speaking scholars can go out and check, okay, who has done what project, who has published which study, and what should I, you know, work on next? Or even locals, they have access to the resources that other organizations created. So we filled in that gap. And so far we have 43 multi-sectoral members on it. With Green Dot, your organization, I'm also proud of that accomplishment. We worked together to educate 2,000 plus young people on intersections between climate change and air pollution through the Tomio app. It's an ed tech app, the most popular app with, I think, around 200,000 users as well. So it was a great success, and we want to continue doing that. And last year, we worked with 25 families. It was an 8-month sustainability training, and then it impacted 73 adults and 46 children living in high pollution districts. And we monitored their indoor air quality, carbon monoxide, PM2.5, and educated them on a monthly basis on different aspects of air pollution, energy efficiency, passive housing, green loans, health impact, and measuring also the cognitive development of their children too, and seeing improvements in it. Our public health expert, Amor Jaraj, led that project that we're grateful for. And this year we secured more grant to subsidize additional families with their transition from coal stoves to electric heaters. And the 10,000 euros will go to the countryside, not only the capital city as well. And so far, we've reached 500 plus people, mostly young adults, on promoting energy efficiency and health protecting practices. Obviously, as we worked heavily on social media, we reached around 19,000 people, mostly under 35, and educate them on clean air and climate change. When it comes to our aspirations, we'll continue focusing on the youth because they're the future of our country. We must build capacity. We must inspire the youth to become engineers and scientists so they can make science and fact-based decisions to shape the country. And then we're also training journalists to reach a wider audience. So they are also educating people on science and facts and not mislead them. And then getting into the roots of the issue, more shift to climate, energy, poverty, inequitable education work. Pollution in Mongolia is an energy problem. So we're going to focus heavily on energy advocacy and work with the government, not against it, on issues like open air quality data, and then build regional centers across the country, not just the capital city.
Thank you, Azad. That was such an interesting answer, and may all your aspirations come true very quickly and very effectively. Before we close, I want to hear your personal story as well. While we know part of how your engagement with air pollution and activism came to be, what inspired you to work in finance and technology? As you equip more communities and individuals to fight for cleaner air back home in Mongolia, is there anything you'd like to tell our listeners who may be struggling with similar crises where they live?
Yeah, my career choice has been maybe slightly accidental. I came to the U.S. to study MBA.
As an MBA student, I wanted to work for a company that aligned with my values, such as positive public health impact or environmental impact. And I had no desire to market sugary cereals or soda drinks to children. A schoolmate of mine introduced me to IBM after his summer internship, and I was impressed by how IBM addressed many of the world's challenges through technology. So I applied for an intern and then later on a full-time position. And their finance department was open to hiring international students. After 9 years of working there and leading volunteers from the company to work on air pollution projects, I decided to switch my career to climate and sustainability full-time recently. Currently, I am supporting Orda, a startup specializing in ESG investment and regenerative finance, with their business development in the US and also their tech project management. For those listeners who want to make a difference in the issues they're passionate about, I would recommend that you select one or two significant challenges and delve deeply into them. Research the issue, find organizations or others who also want to solve the problem, volunteer with them, donate to the organization. Also, talk about it with everyone who will listen and write about it. You can also organize events, protest, when necessary, sign petitions, vote for politicians who represent your values and stance on important issues, and even run for an election yourself. It's really important to hold decision makers accountable. Also, even with the choices you make with your own money that you earn, you can invest in portfolios that align with you and divest from those that you don't align, and even boycott when necessary certain brands and businesses that you don't agree with. Find alternative products and services. You don't have to be an expert or science to make a difference. Just dedicate your current skills and talents to the cause, whether it's, you know, marketing or graphic design, or even singing or painting murals. Whatever you can do will be helpful. And everyone can do something, and everyone must take action. Otherwise, things are not looking so great. When discouraged, you can always take a break, recharge, and come back reinvigorated with increased motivation and energy. So yeah, that's all I would say to the listeners who are also dealing with different crises in wherever they live.
Great. Thank you so much, Aza, for all the novel sharing and all the work that you do in Nagoya. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
With that, I would like to thank our guests, Azjar Galsotsa Khan, and our interviewer, Karel Tuya Bayanmu, for joining us on this episode of Atmospheric Tales. Thanks to all our listeners for tuning in. Make sure to subscribe and share.